The passage of the 13th Amendment, which outlawed slavery, almost didn't pass. This hour, we go back to the 1860s with one of the historical consultants on the new film, Lincoln. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour is historian Thomas Schwartz, one of the foremost experts on Abraham Lincoln. Schwartz is currently the director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library. We'll find out about the historical accuracy of the new Lincoln film, what it was like to tour Springfield, Illinois with actor Daniel Day-Lewis, and also shine a light on the complicated legislative process that led to the passage of the 13th Amendment. Join our conversation this hour as we discuss Abraham Lincoln after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The 16th president of the United States has been getting a lot of attention from Hollywood over the past few months. Back in June, if you remember, a film, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, came out. And in that film, President Lincoln discovers vampires are planning to take over the U.S. He makes it his mission to eliminate them. The newer film, titled simply Lincoln, has been out for just a few weeks to much acclaim. Lincoln is a historical drama film directed and produced by Steven Spielberg, starring Daniel Day-Lewis as Abraham Lincoln, Sally Field as Mary Todd Lincoln. And the film is based in part on Doris Kearns Goodwin's biography of Lincoln titled Team of Rivals. It covers the final 4 months of Lincoln's life, focusing on Lincoln's efforts in January of 1865 to have the 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution pass the U.S. House of Representatives, outlawing slavery. My guest this hour, as we focus on Lincoln for the entire hour, is historian Thomas Schwartz. He's one of the foremost experts on Abraham Lincoln. He's currently director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library in West Branch, and he worked as a historical consultant on both of these films. Thomas Schwartz. Tom Schwartz, welcome back to our program.
Thanks, Ben.
Listeners, especially if you've seen the new Spielberg film, Lincoln, starring Daniel Day-Lewis, we want you to join in our conversation this hour. What did you think of it? What surprised you? What questions do you have about that portrayal of Lincoln and his times? What relevancy is there for us in our times? 1-866-780-9100, River to River, and iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. I wonder if you could start off by reminding us, Tom Schwartz, what is the job of a historical consultant in such a film, such films?
Well, the role of a historical consultant is obviously to address the immediate questions that spring up regarding the film. And sometimes that deals with specifically accuracy of a statement that a character may utter in dialogue, to the actual design of costumes. A lot of what we answered, what I answered and what my staff answered for both those films dealt with things as minor as the kinds of buttons and collars. To kind of speech patterns. I know that one of the questions that every actor that approaches Lincoln and asks is, what did his voice sound like? And there is, you know, the simple answer is, well, obviously we don't know. However, you know, people say, well, yeah, there were no recordings of Lincoln's voice. Well, there might be. There was a process that was invented in 1857, which used a piece of paper covered with soot, and a stylus was put on top, and the vibrations created a groove similar to a modern record. They have been able to lift the sound off of some of these early impressions, the earliest one being 1860. One is claimed to have been made of Lincoln's voice, though We don't have firm evidence that that exists.
You haven't heard it. Has anyone heard it?
No. No. We know by contemporary accounts that he had a high-pitched voice. Some refer to it as a reedy tenor. But we also know that during the Lincoln-Douglas debates, Lincoln's voice was much more audible in an open space simply because it was higher pitched and it carried. Now, even at that, it probably didn't get past the first one or two rows of people. You're talking about events that would gather anywhere from 5 to some of the larger ones, 20,000 people. And with all of the crowd noise, it was very difficult to hear the speakers. But Stephen A. Douglas had a baritone voice, which works very well in the Senate chambers, where there are all these hard surfaces and it resonates. But when you go outside, that gets immediately lost. It drops. And so I think Daniel Day-Lewis probably relied upon the audio tapes of the Library of Congress, which went around in the 30s collecting regional speech patterns and kind of used the southern Indiana twang to his.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of Daniel Day-Lewis in his portrayal of Abraham Lincoln in Lincoln. And this is a scene I wanted to play the clip I'm sure you're familiar with, where he refers to the Greek mathematician Euclid and remind us of the context. He's he's sending a telegraph here. Because if you don't know the context, you'll wonder what it's about. Tell us before we hear it.
Yeah, Lincoln's in the telegraph office in the War Department, which is right next to the White House. And he needs to respond to a query about the Confederate peace commissioners and whether or not they could come to Washington. And so Lincoln is trying to think of his reply before he gives it to the young telegraph operator.
Okay, so he's thinking out loud to these two young men, and this is a clip from Lincoln.
Euclid's first common notion is this: things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other. That's a rule of mathematical reasoning. It's true because it works. Has done and always will do. In his book, Euclid says this is self-evident. You see, there it is. Even in that 2,000-year-old book of mechanical law, it is a self-evident truth that things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other.
So are we to take there that he is making the point, he is deciding out loud that freeing the slaves is more important than ending the war more quickly?
Sure. I mean, one of Lincoln's basic premises is that he believed in the Declaration that all men are created equal. He didn't believe that equality was a quality of ability, a quality of talents, but that in natural law that they were all equal in the race of life to strive as far as they could with their God-given talents and abilities. Some will rise higher, some lower, but they ought not have someone take the fruits of their labor from them for themselves. And this is what slave masters did. They robbed slaves of the fruits of their own labors and took it to themselves. And so Lincoln believed that blacks met the definition of men that in the Declaration, and therefore they deserved at least that basic level of equality.
I understand that when Daniel Day-Lewis was researching this role, you took him, as well as Doris Kearns Goodwin, the writer of a Lincoln biography, Team of Rivals, to Springfield, Illinois. That's where young Mr. Lincoln practiced law, served in the Illinois State Legislature as a young man. Tell us about that day.
Well, I had actually worked with Doris for a much longer period. When she began the book Team of Rivals, she made a trip to Springfield and came several times in the course of the events. And so she was an old friend. Kathleen Kennedy, who was one of the producers, asked if she would set this trip up, and Kathleen Kennedy was also in attendance. Daniel Day-Lewis wanted to get a sense of the environment in Illinois where Lincoln developed as a politician, as a husband, as a lawyer. And even though these things wouldn't be covered in the film, it was all part of understanding the background to the character for the portions that would be portrayed.
So the questions for you that he had for you as a historian in Springfield on that tour?
Yeah, I mean, he was asking when we went to the old state capitol, you know, what's the connection of this building to Lincoln? And therefore, and so, you know, the Supreme Court was where Lincoln argued cases as a lawyer. The House of Representatives was where Lincoln served really his last term in the House, because the Capitol had been in Vandalia before that time. But also he gave his House Divided speech, which was essentially his acceptance speech in running for as Senate Republican senatorial candidate in 1858. When he died, his body returned and lay in state in the old state capitol in the Hall of Representatives. We went to the Lincoln home, and there he got to see kind of where Lincoln spent time as a father and as a husband. We went to the law offices, and he got to see where Lincoln learned to practice the craft that made him one of the leading attorneys in Illinois. Mm-hmm. We went to the museum. And what's interesting is, you know, those of you who've been to the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum in Springfield, there are two journeys. Journey one takes you from his boyhood in Indiana. We start the story in Indiana, his love of books, and takes you to his election as president. And then journey two begins in the White House and then takes you through his assassination and the bringing of his body back. Before we got to the Ford's Theater Gallery, he stopped and he said, "I don't want to go any farther." He said, "because my portrayal of Lincoln is that of a living Lincoln." He said, I don't want to dwell on this part because it's not part of my character."
How interesting. Now this work that you did with Steven Spielberg, Daniel Day-Lewis, with Doris Kearns Goodwin, took place several years ago. Then you see a screening of this film. You see Daniel Day-Lewis embody Lincoln. What was your initial reaction?
I was impressed. I mean, initially, I was part of a group of historians that went to New York. Steven Spielberg had already – he bought the rights to the book before the book had even been written, and you know, which is obviously a problem, and had two script treatments written, neither of which he liked. So he decided he'd bring in a screenwriter that he admired a great deal and who he had worked with before, and this was Tony Kushner. They had worked on Munich together. And he wanted to be Kushner brought up to speed. And so he brought a number of historians to New York City, videotaped it. Doris Kearns Goodwin was there. Kathleen Kennedy was there. Tony Kushner. And at that time, Liam Neeson had been contracted to play Lincoln. And I asked him, I said, "well, why'd you choose Liam Neeson?" And he said, "well, you know, we took photographs of all of the actors and we put them through a computer program that matched them up point for point on certain facial recognition patterns with those of Lincoln. And Liam Neeson came out the highest in terms of looking most like Lincoln. Plus, you know, he's a wonderful actor and he's 6'4", which is Lincoln's height." I think Neeson got tired of waiting and asked to get out of his contract. And so then Daniel Day-Lewis was brought in to replace him. A brilliant decision. I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis is one of our most talented and gifted actors. And I think what I loved about his portrayal of Lincoln is that you actually can see the gears grinding. Those of you who are familiar with Lincoln's writings, and they're not that extensive, but they are at the very best works of art. And there's a lot of silences. You know, Lincoln understood performance, that a political speech was not only what you say, but how you say it, and that pauses. I mean, if you look at his kind of the drafts of his speeches, he gives you very clear guidelines of how you should phrase it and where you should pause. And Daniel Day-Lewis was really very good at providing those pauses that allow you to reflect.
If you've just joined us, my guest this hour is Lincoln historian Thomas Schwartz. He worked as a historical consultant on both Lincoln, the Steven Spielberg film just out with Daniel Day-Lewis, and earlier this year, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. In this latest film, something also much talked about in the film, a far more forgiving portrayal of Mary Todd Lincoln than perhaps popular opinion has had up to this point. Here's a clip of Mr. and Mrs. Lincoln viewing an opera from that film. Mrs. Lincoln frustrated that her husband has ultimately extended the war, denying a treaty with the South in order to pass this 13th Amendment to end slavery. This happens at the same time that their eldest son, Robert, has chosen to enlist. Let's listen to this clip.
You think I'm ignorant of what you're up to because you haven't discussed this scheme with me as you ought to have done? When have I ever been so easily bamboozled? I believe you when you insist that amending the Constitution and abolishing slavery will end this war. And since you are sending my son into the war, woe unto you if you fail to pass the amendment.
Seward doesn't want me leaving big muddy footprints all over town.
No one has ever lived who knows better than you the proper placement of footfalls on treacherous paths. Seward can't do it. You must. Because if you fail to acquire the necessary votes, woe unto you, sir, you will answer to me.
If you fail, woe unto you, sir, you will answer to me. Mary Todd Lincoln, really that much of a heavy?
What I liked about the film is that it portrayed Mary as someone of influence. And I think too often biographers write her out. Typically, the way they emphasize her name, it's Mary Todd Lincoln, kind of separating her from her husband.
Like Hillary Rodham Clinton.
But if you look at the way she would sign her name, it was always Mary Lincoln. Mm. She never emphasized her maiden name, the Todd. And they do the same thing with his eldest son, Robert, because, again, you know, it's Robert Todd Lincoln, and he was like his mother. You know, he's not at the same caliber in the same league as Abraham Lincoln, right? Abraham, and this is shown in the carriage scene at the very end when she talks about how people had claimed she was a bad influence on him and a distraction and an impediment. And he said, well, they don't know you. And whatever one may think in looking at that marriage from the outside and looking at Mary's behavior, sometimes very bad public behavior, it worked. They made it work. And I think part of it was that she did provide a way for him to bounce ideas. She certainly was very open about her own views. But she also forced him to do things that he wouldn't have done. The carriage rides, that was her idea. She knew that he needed to get away from the grind of the presidency. And even in breakfast, she would invite guests over and make him eat breakfast again just to have him switch gears for just a very short period of time.
There has been talk that speculation that Mary suffered from bipolar disorder, what we would call that today. Do you see historical evidence of that?
Well, people also claim that Lincoln was clinically depressed. I mean, it's very difficult, to make these diagnoses with any certainty. And I think, when people say that Mary was bipolar, part of my problem with that is in later life, you don't have the same documentation of the outbursts that people use as evidence in earlier life. If she were really, truly bipolar, you would have those occurring throughout her life all the way up to her death. And they simply aren't there.
We have to take a break in just a minute, but perhaps you can answer this as a historian, a Lincoln historian, in the portrayal of Abraham Lincoln in this film and Mary Todd Lincoln. If we had two circles, let's take Lincoln first of all, the real historical Lincoln based on documentation and the portrayal by Daniel Day-Lewis, how much would those circles overlap?
Okay.
In your view, of course.
Yeah, no, I think he gets the essence of Lincoln. I mean, I think he gets the core of Lincoln, both as someone who's introspective, at times self-absorbed, someone who uses stories to good effect, and someone who ultimately is a process man. And that's something we should talk about later.
A process man. Okay. We'll come back. Just a second. Maybe you want to elaborate on that. Perhaps tell us what you think briefly was missed maybe in the character. A weakness in the character when matching it up to the real historical Lincoln? And we can come back to that too.
Let me think about that during the break.
Okay. We'll come back after okay. After a short break. Historian Thomas Schwartz with us, one of the foremost experts on Abraham Lincoln. He's also currently director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library in West Branch. He worked as one of the historical consultants on the new film, Lincoln. If you have questions, have you seen the new Steven Spielberg film, Lincoln, starring Daniel Day-Lewis and Sally Field? What did you think of it? What surprised you? What questions do you have about the portrayal of Lincoln in his times? What relevancy do you think that film has for us today? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Our toll-free number, river2river@iowapublicradio.org, our email. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. When we come back, we'll talk more about this film, but also the earlier film, loosely based on Abraham Lincoln. Tom Schwartz also consulted for that film, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. When we come back. More with Lincoln historian Thomas Schwartz. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and we're focusing this hour on portrayals of the 16th President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, two films being out this year, Lincoln most recently, the much-acclaimed Steven Spielberg film starring Daniel Day-Lewis and Sally Field. Earlier this year, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. We have historian Thomas Schwartz with us, one of the foremost experts on Abraham Lincoln, worked as a historical consultant on both of these films. If you have a question, 1-866-780-9100, our toll-free number. Before we went to that break, Thomas Schwartz, Tom, we were talking, you wanted to talk a little bit about process, that Lincoln was a process man. What do you mean by that?
Oftentimes we think of leadership as being, you know, the single individual who stands up against everything else and kind of just by sheer will is able to bring about a right conclusion. Lincoln was very much a process guy. He kind of had a Whiggish notion of the president. He really believed that the president should defer to Congress. And throughout most of his presidency, most of the major acts that defined his presidency, the Homestead Act, the Morrell Act, which set up land-grant colleges, Transcontinental Railroad, you don't see his fingerprints on it. I mean, he pretty much left Congress to move forward with that. All of that had been the Republican platform. And when the southern states seceded, much of the Democratic opposition went with it. And so even though the northern Democrats often could be formidable, they just didn't have the numbers. And so Republican agenda was able to pretty much be carried out. What Lincoln was trying to do with the whole thing about slavery was that it didn't lend itself to a tidy process. Slaves were defined as property, and the Constitution protects property rights. So the Emancipation Proclamation was used as his powers as commander-in-chief. And it was a temporary act. As long as the war was going on, Lincoln claimed he could free slaves that were in areas in rebellion to the North. Now, this also meant that those areas in the South that had already been occupied by Union forces were exempt. It also meant that the border states, Missouri, Kentucky, Maryland, Delaware, were exempt because they were not in rebellion. So it did not free all the slaves. It was selective. The other issue that Lincoln feared is that if the war ended abruptly and the whole issue of slavery were not resolved, there was nothing that would prevent slave owners from using the courts, petition the courts to have their property returned. Therefore, the 13th Amendment was absolutely vital to be passed and in place before the war ended. It was a matter of process. It was one of the few times where Lincoln involved himself in the legislative branch,
right,
in order to move this forward. So that's what also makes this whole four-month window very important and somewhat unique because, again, Lincoln is, again, kind of running counter to what he would have preferred, and that is kind of define what the president does versus what Congress does and help Congress move the process along. But he was very clear on what he could and couldn't do. And he even knew when he was doing something that exceeded his powers, he knew he was doing that. The first 100 days, he knew that he spent money that Congress had not appropriated. But he felt that it was better to ask for forgiveness than permission.
We have a caller, Elijah from Ames, I think, in this very area. You have a question. Elijah, welcome to our program.
Hi. It wasn't actually a question. It was rather a comment about the movie. It's just been interesting to see filmmakers return to the politics of past presidents rather than the history surrounding them. I've been, in my political science class, I've been discussing the prerogative theory of Lincoln, which essentially meant that the president had to do whatever it took to save the Union and the Constitution. And his dilemma was he had to violate the Constitution in order to save it. And I think you mentioned it earlier. It was to the effect in the Constitution, it said, we find these truths to be self-evident. So I just found that very interesting.
Elijah, thank you for that comment from Ames. Before our hour ends, I want to make sure, and as long as we're on this film, before we move on to Vampire Hunter, another historical figure that jumps out in this film was that of Thaddeus Stevens, played by Tommy Lee Jones, very colorfully here. Let's hear a little bit of Tommy Lee Jones playing Thaddeus Stevens on the floor of the house.
How can I hold that all men are created equal when here before me stands stinking the moral carcass of the gentleman from Ohio? Proof that some men are inferior, endowed by their maker with dim wits, impermeable to reason, with cold, pallid slime in their veins instead of hot red blood. You are more reptile than man, George. So low and flat that the foot of man is incapable of crushing you.
How dare you?
Tommy Lee Jones portraying Thaddeus Stevens, a pivotal scene in the film where Stevens is advocating the 13th Amendment, denouncing Congressman George Pendleton, a representative from Ohio and an anti-abolitionist. Did Thaddeus Stevens really speak these words? Very insulting words.
Thaddeus Stevens certainly was capable of angering his enemies. I think the problem with Tommy Lee Jones' portrayal, which was very entertaining, was that it and this is true with almost all of the other members of Congress, is that they're not given the same kind of depth of understanding that we have for Lincoln. And in fact, Lincoln is and maybe Mary are really the only two figures that you really get a sense of what's going on beneath the surface. Thaddeus Stevens was a very bright man and often could just knock out his enemies with the force of his logic rather than having to resort to character attacks. But, I mean, an example.
Would he resort to something like this? Did he resort to something like this?
Yeah. When Lincoln asked him when he was trying to create his cabinet about Simon Cameron, who was one of the chief political operatives in Pennsylvania, but had a very shady career. And Lincoln asked Stevens if Cameron could be trusted. And Stevens said, well, I don't think he would steal a red-hot stove. And
not saying much.
and that got back to Cameron, and Cameron demanded apology. And so Stephen goes to the floor and he says, I said that Mr. Cameron would not steal a red hot stove. I take that back. So, I mean, he could.
He would steal. OK.
He could get under the skin of his opponents. But I think by and large, it obscures the fact that you had a very fine legal mind there and also a very capable politician and one who was not so high-minded that he didn't understand that politics required give and take.
We want to talk a little bit about Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. It came out a little bit earlier this year, which you also consulted. We're a historical consultant too. Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter released back in June, an action fantasy horror film based on a 2010 mashup novel of the same name. In short, President Lincoln discovers vampires are planning the takeover of the United States. He makes it his mission to eliminate them. Here's the character called Henry early in the film opening up to a young Mr. Lincoln, opening up his eyes to the existence of legions of vampires.
Vampires have been in the New World for centuries, slaughtering native tribes and early settlers. But when the Europeans arrived with their slaves, the dead saw a sinister opportunity. They built an empire in the south. But in recent years, they pressed north, leaving death in their wake. It falls to us, Abraham, the hunters, to keep the balance, to ensure that this remains a nation of men and not monsters.
What we do not for one man, but for the good of all mankind.
That from Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. So tell me, as a historical expert on Lincoln, what part did you play in weaving a sort of fictional vampire nation with the historical Lincoln Civil War era? What did they ask you to do on this film?
Seth Graham Smith was the author And he also did the screenplay. They were a lot of the questions with the Vampire Hunter regarded questions about what kind of office, law office, did he have? How was it furnished? What was the attire of the time? What kind of axe did he use?
So the trappings were historically accurate.
The trappings. But then when they were trying to figure out how they could come up with the plot line and with getting, you know, the vampires in it, they wanted to do something about Lincoln's secret plan for emancipation. And I said, you know, it doesn't have to be a secret plan. I mean, emancipation was a controversial enough concept of Lincoln's own time. And, you know, the fact that Lincoln did have these relationships with African Americans at a time when, most people had separate spheres, and they said, what do you mean? And so I told him about his relationship with William H. Johnson. And Johnson ends up becoming a character in the film.
He's the African-American in the film. That is actually a fairly major role alongside the Lincoln character.
He's the only African-American that Lincoln takes with him in the party as president-elect from Springfield to Washington.
In actual historical fact.
In actual historical fact. He tries to get Johnson a job on the White House staff. Johnson being a dark-skinned black, the White House staff being light-skinned blacks, he was rejected. Lincoln, in historical fact, gets him a job in the Treasury Department as a clerk. Salmon P. Chase is an abolitionist, Treasury Secretary in his cabinet. Lincoln uses Johnson for various activities and errands throughout his presidency, and sends a note to the Treasury Department saying, William comes with me to Gettysburg. William Johnson served as Lincoln's valet en route to Gettysburg, where Lincoln gave a little speech. And when they returned to Washington, Lincoln, unbeknownst, he was already symptomatic of smallpox, but it hadn't expressed itself at Gettysburg. But when he got back to Washington, he took to bed for weeks. And, you know, he quipped, you know, now that I have something to give everyone, no one's here. Because, you know, office seekers had always hounded him. William Johnson also got smallpox, which eventually killed him. And Lincoln, at his own expense, buried Johnson in Arlington National Cemetery in the oldest section where many of the contrabands are buried. But on the tombstone, it's William H. Johnson, citizen. Now, all of this is a way of showing that emancipation was not merely something that was cerebral for Lincoln. I mean, there was something more to it. And the Spielberg film shows it with Mary's relationship with Elizabeth Keckley. A Vampire Hunter shows it with Lincoln's relationship with William Johnson. Both films emphasize, though, that portray Lincoln as a hero, Vampire Hunter as a superhero. But ultimately, they both focus on the same thing, slavery as being the issue and slavery, the end of slavery being Lincoln's greatest achievement and triumph.
Jamie from Cedar Rapids had called. He wanted to know what your reaction was when you were asked to consult on the Vampire Hunter movie. Did you, I suppose, initially think that would be beneath a serious presidential historian?
I'm asked to do lots of stuff that, being a public servant, you don't get to really pick and choose what you can and what kind of questions you can answer and what questions you don't answer. I think both offered great opportunities because they're directed at different audiences. And typically, a good work of fiction or a good fantasy will raise the same kind of questions that will drive someone to the internet to research more or pick up a book. Mm-hmm. And that's what you want. I mean, I think that with the Spielberg film, people are talking about Lincoln. They're going out picking up books. They're doing research on the web. And that's all to the good. If it sparks interest and gets people to explore the questions, explore the people, then the movie served its purpose.
It's interesting that you brought out, made a point of talking about the black valet, William H. Johnson, in the Vampire Hunter, because he plays such a prominent role in that film. And one of the criticisms of Lincoln, Spielberg's Lincoln, this from Kate Masur, an associate professor at Northwestern University. She writes about slavery, race, and civil war for the New York Times. As she wrote, "It's disappointing that a movie devoted to explaining the abolition of slavery in the United States, African-American characters do almost nothing but passively wait for white men to liberate them." So is there, in one narrow sense, more truth in The Vampire Hunter than in Lincoln?
That would be an exaggeration. You know, Kate Masur at Northwestern, his friend, and her entire field of study is to look to see what actions blacks took themselves.
Were they too passive in this portrayal?
Well, they created scenes that probably didn't happen. I mean, I kind of doubt that Lincoln would be sitting there listening to two black soldiers and one would be able to recite the Gettysburg Address.
The opening of the film.
Yeah. But what that does underscore is the fact that Lincoln early on pushed to get black troops used by white military commanders to help bring a greater end to the war. He felt that if white America saw blacks, they had skin in the game, and that they were fighting for their own freedom, that this would also allow white America at war's end to realize that they had an obligation to repay blacks for their blood sacrifice to save their union, and that black freedom was, again, the payment.
You have such a fascinating – I'm sure I echo a lot of the thoughts of listeners out there. You have such a fascinating job here as a historian, as a presidential historian of Lincoln. How specifically did you, Tom Schwartz, get into working as a consultant for films?
when you're in a job working at a research library, as I did in Illinois – as I do now for the federal government, you get all sorts of interesting queries from all quarters. And occasionally those are Hollywood production companies that have a question for a project. So while The Vampire Hunter and the Spielberg Lincoln were not the first films that I was provided information for, It was probably the most extensive, and with the Spielberg, to the extent that they even gave me a film credit at the very, very end. I mean, you have to stay all the way to the bitter end because, you know, they acknowledge people alphabetically, and since Schwartz comes near the end of the alphabet, you know, I'm just – there are a few people below me and then all of the trademarked logos.
Since Lincoln is one of the most studied presidents, the most perhaps arguably one of the most revered presidents in U.S. history, is there anything left to uncover in the study of him? A big unanswered question in your mind?
Oh, well, sure. there was an entire book that came out 2 years ago that dealt with that whole question of the influence of Euclid's, Lincoln's reading of Euclid on his thought.
Really?
Yes. I think Lincoln – there are 17,000 volumes that have been written on Abraham Lincoln. It's more than any other president and one of the most written about figures in all of world history. So when you think that there's nothing more to be said, you realize that you'll think of something.
Okay. We have time for one question you would like to know about Lincoln that is on the lips of other Lincoln historians. What is the question that a genie could answer quickly? Do you have one?
Well, the question that everyone asks is, if Lincoln had lived, how would Reconstruction be different?
Great question. Lincoln historian Thomas Schwartz, currently director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library in West Branch, one of the historical consultants on both Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, and Lincoln, Steven Spielberg. Thank you very much for joining us, Tom Schwartz.
Thanks, Ben.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden and Emily Woodbury. Production assistants today from Caitlin Fry. Executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tune in tomorrow for Politics Wednesday. Thanks for joining us.